I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
In a world where very few people embrace their global identity and seek to understand their neighbors, cross-cultural expert Tayo Roxon is on a mission to bridge this divide. Each week, he'll open your mind with insights from some of the global minds in the world. Get ready, take some notes, and learn how to be the best you that you can be.
Welcome everybody to another episode of As Told by Nomads, and today's episode is with Dan Farner. Dan is the Director of Marketing Services for Smallbox, which is a full-service digital agency in Indianapolis that is passionate by using web to start a culture-powered marketing revolution. His expertise in marketing runs the gamut from providing strategic and organization health consulting for international nonprofit organizations to managing advertising and marketing for national musicians. So very well, you know, put together, but also diverse. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Hey, Tayo. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure is mine. So we were talking before the show, and you were explaining to me kind of how you got into this field of work. Can you talk, you know, to the audience and tell them what your journey's been like up until this point?
Yeah, you bet. So the very end of my bio is really where it started with as a musician. And I graduated from college in 2006 in Muncie, Indiana, which is also known as Middletown, USA, and thought, well, if there's ever a time to start a band and go on tour, that time would be now. And so I did that, lived with my bandmates in Indianapolis for about three of the craziest years you could imagine, toured all over the country, burned myself out, and then realized that I had found a bit of a passion in marketing and promotion that I was able to capitalize on by working for an agency based in Indianapolis. And so that agency grew and evolved. At the time, you know, in 2008, 2009, the world was really, or the marketing world at least, was really starting to become focused on digital marketing. So digital advertising, SEO, content marketing, and social media were really starting to become popular. And so we really tried to capitalize on that. But over time, realized there was a little bit of a higher purpose to brand and marketing and creating great customer experiences. So we evolved as well. And today, even though I think a lot of your intro was probably focused, or at least, you know, what you introduced me as, Smallbox, my company, focused on digital marketing. We've really evolved to think of ourselves more as a what we consider to be a culture-powered brand experience agency, which is quite a bit different than just marketing, a little more broad. So I can break that down as we go as well.
Oh, please. No, please do. Please do. I'm very interested because we are all about culture here on the As Told by Nomads podcast. And when you say culture-powered marketing, what does that entail?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, we're thinking about this as organizational culture, not necessarily racial or gender equality or cultural in that sense. We're focused more on organizational culture, which has become really somewhat of a buzz topic in the U.S., especially over the last several years. And in many ways, it's become a differentiator. So you think about companies like Zappos, or let's think of another great example. Oh, Southwest Airlines is a really great example. Companies that have really helped or taken the time to be intentional and define their culture have really attracted talent and gotten a lot of really interesting accolades. So it ends up that by investing in culture and defining that, and by using your employee base as really that the glue that can help define your culture, it can really create a ripple effect. So you know, your employees are happy, excited, they're creating great experiences for your customer as well. So that's kind of really where the culture powered aspect starts to emanate from a brand. So that's a really high level explanation of what we consider to be culture powered branding or marketing, what have you. And, you know, the question really becomes, well, okay, if this is culture powered, what is culture? You know, how do you define that? And we define it really pretty simply. There's a lot of things that could be lumped into that bucket, but some of the biggest and most foundational are organizational mission, vision, purpose, and values. And, you know, a lot of companies, nonprofits, et cetera, have those defined. But I think the missing ingredient is that they're oftentimes defined by leadership or defined by a board and not necessarily owned by a team. And that's the difference. So if we can take the time to get the team involved in that practice or that activity, they're more likely to feel invested and have ownership over the brand. So that's taking it a step further, maybe to that 1,000-foot level of what culture-powered branding could be. Be using the team to define an organization's culture, which then informs the rest of the brand experience. Does that make sense, Teo?
No, it does. It does. And you know, listening to a lot of what you were saying, you know, I was sharing with you, I definitely heavily involved in a lot of the, you know, a lot of the other culture aspects, whether it's diversity, inclusion, gender, race, you know, age and all that. I'm very curious how this fits into all that. Is there's, because what you're describing to me sounds like a mix of HR and brand, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's really that intersection of HR and brand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, so that intersection of HR and brand, I guess my question then is, do you feel like if we effectively have that intersection between those two components that we can inevitably diversify or have a better culture, work culture, in all the, you know, workplaces that we incorporate design thinking into?
Yeah, I think so. So the idea is that happier employees create a much better service or product, which in turn leads to innovation, leads to great customer experience or customer service, and creates a great brand perception. So, you know, it really ripples outward from that employee experience. So if you think about it, employee experience leads to great customer experience from our perspective.
I guess the reason why I'm very interested in this is I like the idea of promoting meritocracy, basically the idea that the best person gets the job, but also creating great employee engagement within that meritocracy, where the engagement of the employers, you know, leads to, like you said, innovation, but also long-term retention rates and low churn rates. And in your experience working with all these companies and consulting, what have you found has been the biggest pain point with HR and talent acquisition teams?
That is a really good question. I mean, retention is typically the biggest pain point. Turnover and losing top talent. Losing or acquiring top talent is typically the biggest pain point. And so, as I mentioned earlier, you know, defining and actually fostering a great culture can be a real differentiator and a real attractor for top talent. So at least in our experience, that's really a big pain point that we try to, you know, help with kind of from the ground up. So, you know, obviously that can work on a brand level, just on those foundational values and mission and things like that. But then it also obviously takes a step further. And if you think about, you know, some of those companies I mentioned, like Southwest Airlines or Zappos, you know, there is there's a tangible nature to their culture, which is lived out every day. So Zappos is a great example. They do all kinds of different wax Like they'll do like a Halloween, I can't remember what it's called. It's like a, it's on the tip of my tongue. I apologize for blanking on this, but, you know, like at Halloween, they'll do like a scare house kind of thing. But it's not really necessarily scary. But the whole company gets into it and they decorate the entire office. And so, you know, you can go and actually tour the office. And of course you're basically going through like a scare house kind of thing, although it's, I'm sure it's not super scary. It's just more wacky. So that's an example of where the value of fun really is played out in a tangible way, you know, so you can take it a step further and think about that as well. So some of the pain points, I think, which was your original question,
yeah,
are differentiating or creating a desirable enough culture to where, you know, top talent is really, you know, something that you can attract.
No. It's so fascinating to me, this field, because like you did say, the number one thing that I do get is how do I retain top talent, but how do I also retain, you know, a diverse amount of talent? Because you constantly hear that there's diversity on the lower end, you know, on the entry level, but as you go up the field, you don't seem to have, you know, that same diversity reflected, or you don't seem to have the type of retention that they will like. And this goes across just race and gender. It's also age and generations. And I'm always interested in companies like yours, because I'm like, there must be something within the culture that hasn't been reflected up the food chain, because you know, maybe people fall asleep at the wheel when you first hire people and you get them excited, but then the in-between phases needs to be there so that that culture resonates with the employers, employees rather. So, you know, it's fascinating for me when I meet people like yourself who are bringing this innovative ideas into companies, because I feel like, you know, like what you're saying, it's something that needs to be done. But I'm also at the same time always curious why companies are resistant to accepting that. And I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we find that the biggest resistance is probably a focus around profit, or maybe a prioritization of profit over people. In a really simple sense, like, I mean, if you ask any employer, they're probably not going to say out loud that they prioritize profit over people. But, you know, actions speak louder than words. So, you know, that would be the difference, is investing in the team. And that includes, you know, from a professional development standpoint, education, all kinds of different things. You know, one example that I think about that might make this a little more concrete too, you mentioned design thinking earlier, which is a methodology that we at Smallbox use in our project work, because we find that at the heart of design thinking is there's really a few key things. One being a focus on empathizing with humans at the center of a problem, and the second being creating a solution to that problem that can be iterated on very quickly, and getting quick feedback to iterating on that. So basically failing fast. And that's another thing that companies are really afraid to do, is fail overall. I mean, I think big companies have embraced this idea of failing fast and innovation being something that can be very valuable. But, you know, that second tier, you know, medium-sized, smaller companies are probably more averse to failure, you know?
No, I agree. And I think a lot of companies also, you know, they say they want to invest in the talent, but they don't actually apply the minds of investing. Because when you're investing in money and you're investing for your stocks and everything, it's your ideas, you're going to eventually get the dividend in the long run. But you have to have the patience and the time. So when they first experience that first failure, they're like, oh, nope, we got to can this. But if you're investing in like stocks and bonds, you're like, okay, fine. It just went down now, but I know it's going to come back up. You have to apply that mindset, because in the long run, what is the dividend? And that mindset, like you said, the fear of failure, the fact that they can't immediately tie it to the bottom line, I found has been the biggest resistance, because maybe HR team gets it, but the senior management might be under pressure to have certain results. And
yes, you
know, they don't like, well, I get it. I know we're getting killed in the press, whatever, but I need to get this sales objective right now.
So yes, exactly.
Yeah, it's tricky. Well, talk to me more about design thinking, because you all have gotten quite, you know, known for this now. I mean, you lead hands-on workshops that teach you theory and unleash this idea generating practice. And it's started to really, really pick up as people are now accepting that. But you, as the head of Smallbox, have started to become more known for your innovative way of teaching this. So I'm very curious as to what you do with that.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to tell you about design thinking and the way that we utilize it. So design thinking, also known as human-centered design, really comes from the Visual Designer's Toolkit. And the whole idea is that you could kind of flip the thought process of problem solving on its head. If you think of, instead of problem solving, you're designing a solution. So in that way, everyone is a designer. And, you know, oftentimes when during our workshops, which I'll tell you a little bit more about in a minute, we talk about that idea that, you know, well, what if I'm not a designer? I don't know how to draw. Well, everyone's a designer. You know, solution design is design as well. It doesn't have to be visual necessarily. So that's the really big idea. And that's where the term design thinking really has now become very popular, because it's very palatable. It's this idea that you don't have to be a visual designer to really be creative and collaborative. So anyway, that's a little bit about design thinking. There's a few key tenets to it that have become widely adopted. The first is the idea of thinking about research as a practice of empathy, which is a little different in today's modern focus on big data type, you know, marketing philosophy. So
if you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So, you know, the idea of empathizing with a human at the center of a problem is a way to really put yourself in their shoes. So in that way, you're solving for their problem as opposed to based on more quantitative measuring. So there's always a place for quantitative and for data in problem solving and research, of course. But we have, you know, found that by combining that with more qualitative measures like interviewing and diary studies and all kinds of different things, that you can really put yourself in an individual's shoes in a much more concrete way or tangible way.
You know, the reason I love what you're talking about, because you're basically talking about the idea of, you know, because as humans, we're full of surprises, you know, and we make assumptions, but what your approach is unpacking the complexities that we as humans have, and a way for us to challenge those assumptions that we unconsciously or consciously make. Basically,
if you're interested
with that. Yeah. Huh.
Yeah, you're dead on. So that's one of the big tenets of design thinking or human-centered design, is, you know, putting humans at the center of the process. Another big tenet of it, of human-centered design or design thinking, is the idea of prototyping and iterating. So oftentimes in organization, especially in our space, which would be brand or our web, creating a website can be a laborious, like 12 to 18 month process, where you really torture yourself over the copy and all getting all the right words together. When in reality, you know, more cost effectively launch a website in 6 months that may not be, you know, it may not have every single bell and whistle that you could ever imagine, but you can get some very quick feedback upon launching that through user testing and analytics and usability testing, things like that, to iterate on it. over the course of time. So it may be that instead of, you know, taking all the time to get it right and then launching it and then realizing that it's going to fall flat, you take the time to get a minimum viable product, launch that, and then, you know, iterate on it. So it's kind of borrowing from product and engineering, you know, background. So that's another really big tenet of design thinking.
It's funny because when you're describing design thinking, my immediate thought is that it can be hard for people that are used to just diving in quickly and solving the problems, just because, I think people always say this is just a millennial thing, but I think a lot of us have now become programmed to the idea of just having that instant gratification, instant answers, instant solutions to all these things. And we have what you're doing is causing people to just step back and understand how, you know, what data is, what the colleagues' opinions are, you know, what a customer would feel like, and basically go into a problem with that type of mindset.
Yeah, you're dead on. The idea of taking a step back and ultimately putting yourself in someone else's shoes is a really big challenge for us today.
Yeah.
Especially because as a society, we're just wired and taught from, you know, young childhood to solve quickly. And this whole idea of brainstorming, like fast solutions, like throw a bunch of ideas at the wall, became popular. And it, I mean, to a degree, it is effective, but it can only get you so far. And that's the idea, is that if you really need to solve a really challenging problem, like, you know, something that's cross-functional across an organization, or something that is social in nature, like, you know, homelessness, like, you know, you're not going to be able to brainstorm your way through homelessness, as an example. So you've really got to get creative and apply a proven methodology, which is where design thinking really shines.
No, I definitely, I'm empathy, patience, having the long view, thinking big picture and small picture at the same time, and also seeing that this is, it's a culture that needs to have a foundation so that the change magic becomes a lot easier. I think these are all skills that we need to get back to. And reading about you guys, one of my favorite things was when I came across, you know, obviously you can't name the CEO, but you had worked with a seasoned CEO for a Fortune 500 tech company. And he had said to you that his biggest takeaway was that he was moving things into prototyping way much earlier than maybe you should have. And the workshop opened his eyes to lightweight or low fidelity prototypes. So what are low fidelity and lightweight prototypes?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad you brought that example up because it is very concrete. So we host monthly workshops in our building, private ones for companies. But the idea is that you can come and learn about design thinking at a really high level. So it's an intro to design thinking, essentially. It's a workshop, but it's very hands-on, very interactive. So we take you through the process and the methodology using activities. So you're actually learning as you do. So we call that teach as we do. And, you know, as opposed to, you know, kind of sitting through a PowerPoint presentation. The big takeaway that he had, his eyes were opened around this concept of prototyping, which is what I was just talking about, where you launch a minimum viable product and find a way to fail fast, as opposed to taking, you know, 18 months to build a perfect solution that when you finally do launch, it falls flat. And that's essentially had been their approach in the past. And they're really this mix of product and service-based you know, company. And so, you know, for them, they really needed, he found that they could apply that iterative type of prototyping to their, you know, process in order to get solutions to life quickly. So that was the idea.
Yeah, I love it. So musician, now design thinking professional, Dan, what do you do with your off time?
Oh, that's a great question. So I have four young kids. One is four, one is two, and I have 6-month-old twins. So My off time is basically holding babies. But it's been a wild ride for the last several years. But what's so fascinating to me is that so much of design thinking is rooted in play and being creative. And kids are the most creative people you could ever imagine. Yeah. Young kids, they're all imagination. They play pretend constantly. And my 4-year-old, he just wants to play pretend all day. Like, we could play Paw Patrol all day. that would make, you know, that would just change, that would, that's all he could ever imagine doing. And so it's really a struggle for me, who has essentially had the play like beaten out of me over the years in school and, you know, in the workplace, et cetera, to embrace that, even though that's what I tout on a daily basis. So I spend my time playing with my kids and really trying to embrace that concept of play.
So what you're saying is that we should all learn how to be childlike every day.
Yeah, essentially. Or, you know, just take the time to be playful and find joy in simple everyday things. Like, you know, work can be monotonous in some cases. It can obviously inspire us. And there's so many social elements. If you do work, obviously, if you spend your days, you know, at home with kids or as a caretaker or what have you, there's elements of joy and play in every single day. And I think we as a society struggle to see those. I know I do myself, even though it's like literally right in front of me when I wake up with my kids. So, you know, I think that's something that we can really learn from.
No, I agree. I think it's funny, as kids, we all, especially when we're really young, we think we can achieve anything. And we ask all the right questions and we're like, Dad, Mom, why is this? Why? So we're curious. We're trying to figure out the point of view from the other person. And then as we grow older, we become afflicted with this curse called realism, where we have to be realistic and the world is telling you, well, you are not going to be able to do that. And then we start to believe that as we get older, and then we get to high school and college, and it's like, okay, well, what I used to believe is not the same. So the idea of being childlike, I love that, because then you feel like your options are limited and you're just genuinely curious. You just want to know what the other diverse, whatever, like, why does that person not look like me? Why did that person say that? Why you ask all these questions so innocently? And I think we have to adapt that again.
Exactly. You're dead on there. And it's hard. It's hard to do. So, you know, that's a big challenge.
Yeah. No, this is good. All right. So I'm an HR executive, right? And I'm thinking, man, I really just listened to Dan's interview. He broke it down. I need that in my company. What do I need to do as an HR executive to just reach out to you?
Oh, sure. Well, I'd love to talk to you,
HR. Oh, you'd love to talk to me, HR exactly.
visit us at smallbox.com, smallbox.com, and we can talk to you about various ways to help with talent attraction and retention, creating a great culture, or, you know, taking a look at your brand and your brand story to really bring it to life in a much more rich and meaningful way. At the very least, we can you know, show you what a design thinking workshop looks like. And if you're in the Midwest, you know, that might make sense for you to attend one of ours, but there are also others throughout the country that might make sense. So something I would certainly encourage you, Mr. HR professional, to look into.
Well, you know, for the HR professional and even senior leadership people that might be listening, Smallbox is this Indianapolis-based creative agency, but they can obviously work anywhere. But what they do is they design distinct brands and provide transformational learning experiences that help their clients identify and solve complex problems. We live in a very complex world. The world is going to continue to be more multi-generational, multicultural, and just digitally inclined. So all these things are going to be happening at the same time, and your organization is going to be in that world. And if you're trying to compete or even have a competitive advantage, it'll behoove you to know how to work in those type of environments. And that's exactly what Dan does with his company, and you know, design thinking is an approach that allows you to sort of see things from more than one point of view. So hope you were able to get that from the interview. I don't know if I did you justice there by summarizing that, Dan, but that seems to be what I got from that.
That was good, Dale. I'm impressed. You're hired.
I'm going to wrap up with a few questions here, and these are more just fun variety. So what is your favorite movie of all time?
Ooh, favorite movie of all time. All right. Well, I probably always default to The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, which is a Wes Anderson film, and it came out in like maybe 2010, 2012, something like that. Anyway, Bill Murray, and it's one of his best performances ever. Bill Murray is like my favorite actor because he's so diverse and such like a hilarious, but like in a really a subtle way kind of guy. Mm. And anyway, he plays a ship captain he's searching for he's searching for this mysterious fish that, you know, the world has never seen before to, you know, bring it to society and just the adventures along the way. He's also kind of washed up. So, you know, it's just a hilarious take, really subtle, great humor, but also really playful. So that really speaks to that playful side that I was talking about earlier. So that's always a go-to for me.
Favorite country you've ever been to?
Favorite country? That is a good question. I haven't been to many, but I studied abroad in Italy when I was in college. I was very lucky to be able to do that. And I also went back a few years later, and it turned out that Italians love babies. It's probably the rest of the world just loves babies. That was just a phenomenal experience. So it's kind of like I had a little celebrity with me wherever I went. And so the people I got to meet and the conversations I got to have were just so different than I probably normally would have without bringing my, you know, 7-month-old baby. Gotcha. Didn't sleep, but, you know, when you go into it knowing that, then it's not so bad.
Yeah, no, I agree. And then the last question, which is the mission statement of what I do, and it's use your difference to make a difference. So how do you use your difference to make a difference, Dan?
Whew. Teo, that is so good. well, so that's your mission statement. I have a personal purpose statement, which is a little simpler, but it's promote joy. So I just try to bring joy into my life through my coworkers or my friends on a daily basis. So finding one way to bring joy to somebody else is the way that I try to make a difference. Okay. To use my difference to make a difference.
So you use your difference to make a difference by finding joy and encouraging that in others as well, which is good. Putting a smile on people's faces.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I want to thank you for coming on the show, but once again, it's at smallbox.com, right? That's where people can find you.
Correct.
Anywhere else?
You know, that's probably the best avenue. I'm on all the social medias, obviously. And I have had various music projects, but, none are very active right now. So Smallbox is where you'll find me.
Okay. Smallbox. And then, okay. All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you're looking for different ways to incorporate innovative approaches into your workplace and workforce, also hire and retain talent, check out smallbox.com. Till next week, use your difference to make a difference.
You've just been listening to the As Told by Nomads podcast. For more ways to reach out to Tayo and to use your difference to make a difference, head over to www.tayoroxon.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.